This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
21 days after the New Mexico dress rehearsal, a lone B-29 was over Hiroshima carrying an atomic bomb. At 8:15 in the morning of August 6th, Japanese time, the first atomic bomb hit an enemy target. The bomb was aimed to explode above zero point, a spot in the city at the junction of the Motoyisu and Ota rivers. The bomb was intentionally set to explode well above the zero point to dissipate its radioactivity at zero point directly beneath the explosion. Within a mile of zero point, the devastation speaks for itself. But in these very ruins, Army cameramen have found and filmed pictorial evidence that tells in twisted steel and stone the effect of death-dealing atomic power.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Health and Living, and I'm Lee Chui Lin. 71 years ago, Hiroshima, Japan, was a city of about 350,000 people that was largely untouched by the war. The city was an important manufacturing and military center with at least 40,000 military personnel stationed there during the summer of 1945. When the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, there was a giant mushroom cloud of purple-gray smoke that left what seemed like a 100-foot layer of debris and smoke in its wake. A journalist with Life magazine wrote that in the following waves after the initial blast, people's bodies were terribly squeezed, then their internal organs ruptured. Then the blast blew the broken bodies at 500 to 1,000 miles per hour through the flaming, rubble-filled air. Practically everybody within a radius of 6,500 feet was killed or seriously injured, and all buildings crushed or disemboweled. The bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have left an indelible dark mark on the history of the world. In this two-part commemoration of these events, we speak to the former president of the Malaysian Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Ronald McCoy, who has been against war and nuclear weapons since Hiroshima and Nagasaki suffered the atomic bomb. Dr. McCoy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Lovely. Great to be here.
Do you remember how you learned of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? How did you react?
Yes, you know, this was in 1945, and we were still occupied by the Japanese. There were no newspapers. We only had what we call black market news. And so we heard about this atomic bomb, which was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, of course, we were told that this was the only way in which we could hasten the surrender of Japan and put an end to the war. And so I thought, this must be one of these, you know, very destructive bombs, and left it at that. It was only when I was a medical student in Singapore that I read John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. And only then did I realize what an atomic bomb was, or what a nuclear weapon is, so terribly destructive that it could even destroy the whole planet if we had a nuclear war. And so I felt, as a single medical student, and there was no other organization who was interested in getting rid of nuclear weapons, I just let it go. And then in 1986, I read about the Nobel Peace Prize that was given to international physicians for the prevention of nuclear war in 1985. I read about this in the BMJ, British Medical Journal. And so I said, great, this is an organization I would like to join. So I wrote to them and became a member, an individual member. And then at an MMA meeting, Malaysian Medical Association meeting in Malacca, a year later, at breakfast, I stood up on a table or on a chair and said to the members having breakfast, we have this organization in America, IPPNW. I would like to form Malaysian Doctors Affiliate. Who would join me? And so I sent a piece of paper around, and we got about 42 signatures. So that's how it began.
And at the time of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you didn't know really what an atomic bomb was. But by the time the 1986 Chernobyl and 2011 Fukushima explosions came around, we were a little more informed about what nuclear weaponry or nuclear reactors could do. How did you react to those events?
Chernobyl and Fukushima? Well, I think it was always on the cards that any nuclear power plant has this weakness of a nuclear accident. Mind you, nuclear accidents, major ones, don't happen very often. We've only had two, maybe three, Three Mile Island in America. But there have been hundreds of minor accidents which were arrested in time. But any of those minor accidents could have progressed further and become major accidents. And if you are unable to cope with a major nuclear accident, as we are with Chernobyl and Fukushima, then we're really dicing with a catastrophic accident one day. So I'm hoping the Malaysian government, who is supposed to be making plans to build a nuclear reactor, will change its mind. And we've tried putting out the facts about nuclear reactors, how dreadfully expensive they are, and how unsafe they are. There's no such thing as a safe nuclear reactor. There's always the risk that something can go wrong. And if something can go wrong, this is Murphy's Law, if something can go wrong, in time it will go wrong.
When we talk about these sorts of nuclear events, I mean, aside from being able to wipe out countries, even wipe out our existence and our world, with Chernobyl, with Fukushima, how do you begin to clean up after a nuclear event like that? I mean, how do you begin to kind of mop up the mess, so to speak?
Well, there's no such thing as mopping up the mess. And Chernobyl and Fukushima are very good examples. What they did in Chernobyl was to cover up the damaged radioactive nuclear reactors with what was called, or what is called, a sarcophagus. And a sarcophagus is essentially a coffin made of stone. So they used a lot of concrete and they covered the whole nuclear power plant with concrete. About 5 years ago, cracks have begun to appear. And so there's the leaking of radiation once again. And so what they've done now, in the last 5 years, is they've constructed two structures on wheels, like hangars, if you like, and they have covered the sarcophagus with these protective coverings. Whether or not it's going to work or not, we don't know. But you must remember that radioactivity doesn't last for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. It lasts for thousands of years. Plutonium has a half-life of 42,000 years. A half-life of 42,000 years. So if you take a piece of plutonium, in 420 centuries, half the radioactivity of that lump of plutonium will have dissipated, will have decayed. 420 centuries. We are really talking about radiation forever. So this is very serious.
And it's not really something that we can ever hope to contain, because again, if something can go wrong, something will, and eventually someone will make another mistake.
You know how human beings are. You can take all the precautions you want, but in time, I mean, this is Murphy's Law, in time, it will go wrong.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Ronald McCoy, former president of the Malaysian Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're talking about, the need for nuclear disarmament, the hope of a nuclear-free future. Up next, we find out what Dr. McCoy has seen as the effects of radiation in his career. You are listening today to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Dr. Ronald McCoy, former president of the Malaysian Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're talking about the hopes for a nuclear-free future in conjunction with Hiroshima Day. So after standing on a table at breakfast and gathering, 42 other like-minded people, what has the Malaysian chapter of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, what have you been up to? What inroads have been made?
Well, we are very fortunate because we have a Malaysian government who is very much in favour of the elimination of nuclear weapons. So I've been able to work very closely with the Malaysian government on this issue. And so I give them support and they give me support. And so we have meetings. IPPNW has meetings every year. It used to be every year. It's now every 2 years. And we now have changed our tack in our campaigns. And we have established in 2007 what we've called the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, which has got a nice ring to it,
ICAN.
And what we've done, this is a campaign, and what we've done is we've attracted all the other civil society groups and countries to work now for a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. First, to ban nuclear weapons, and then to eliminate them. That second part is going to be far more difficult than getting a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. We have treaties to ban and eliminate chemical weapons and biological weapons, landmines, cluster munitions, and so forth. Why not we have a treaty to ban and then eliminate nuclear weapons? So that's what we are doing. And 127 countries have come together, 127 countries in the UN have come together, and we've had about five conferences in the last 3 years. The last conference was in Geneva in May this year, which I went to. The next conference is going to be actually next week in Geneva. I'm not going to that one. And the idea now is to put together the format of a treaty, which will then be taken to the UN General Assembly next year, probably. And of course, there'll be lots of opposition to this treaty, but if we have 127 governments with us, we should be able to have this treaty adopted by the United Nations.
It's not immediately apparent the link between physicians and this nuclear disarmament. How important is it for you that physicians, medical specialists, get involved with issues that are beyond purely medical, beyond the sphere of the purely medical?
You see, that's a misconception. Radiation from a nuclear reactor or from a nuclear war is a medical problem. And if we cannot treat any medical condition, then we observe the very important principle of preventive medicine. So if we can't respond as physicians to a nuclear reactor accident or a nuclear war, then we should prevent these terrible disasters. And the way to prevent that is to phase out nuclear reactors and finally dispense with nuclear energy and eliminate nuclear weapons. If we have no nuclear weapons, there will be no nuclear war. If we have no nuclear reactors, there will be no nuclear accidents. And we have other substitutes for energy. And the way to go now with climate change is obviously renewable energy and change the way we live and manufacture goods. The whole economy has to change as well.
Dr. McCoy, so we've talked about how kind of the Malaysian chapter began. What was your interest, you know, that spurred you into starting this chapter? How does your medical career link in with your involvement against nuclear war?
Well, you know, as an obstetrician, you spend maybe 8 or 9 months nurturing a pregnancy, and then you deliver this wonderful, beautiful, healthy baby into a world bristling with nuclear weapons. To me, that doesn't make sense. So I can see very clearly that doctors surely have a professional responsibility to eliminate nuclear weapons because it is a threat to health. So there's almost a direct connection between medicine and radiation and nuclear issues.
What are the health risks associated with nuclear power?
Well, of course, right from the beginning, from the mining of uranium, workers are exposed to radiation, and many of them have fallen ill as a result of that radiation sickness. But of course, during the construction and during the process of producing nuclear energy, there's always a risk of an accident. And as I said before, there have been hundreds of minor accidents which were managed, which were stopped in time. But we've had 2, perhaps 3, if you count Three Mile Island, 2 or 3 major nuclear accidents. And there is no way, as I said just now, there's no way of responding satisfactorily to a nuclear reactor accident. And Fukushima and Chernobyl are very good examples. In Fukushima, they are trying to keep the reactors cool by pumping in water constantly. The water that has been used in the reactors comes out radioactive. And what do you do with this radioactive water? Volumes and volumes of radioactive water. So they're storing them in tanks. Some of these tanks are now leaking, and therefore there's radioactivity going into the ground. But eventually, what are you going to do with this huge volume of radioactive water which is accumulating? And I think eventually, some of it will be disposed of into the Pacific Ocean. What else can we do with radioactive water piling up, with radioactivity which is going to last for a long, long, long time?
You've been listening to Dr. Ronald McCoy, former president of the Malaysian Physicians for Social Responsibility, discussing the issue of nuclear disarmament and why it was important for him, as a doctor, to protest the existence and use of nuclear weapons. This has been the first part of our commemoration of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hear the second part tomorrow when Dr. Ronald explains why he believes there are no safe reactors and how people can voice their concerns over the use of nuclear power. You've been listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
There are many sites around the world that chronicle this war. Memorials that tell stories of courage and heroism. Graves and empty camps that echo of unspeakable depravity. Yet in the image of a mushroom cloud, that rose into these skies, we are most starkly reminded of humanity's core contradiction. How the very spark that marks us as a species, our thoughts, our imagination, our language, our tool making, our ability to set ourselves apart from nature and bend it to our will. Those very things also give us the capacity for unmatched destruction.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.